Oh, hi. This is Cindy Howes from Basic Folk, and here's what's happening on the Bluegrass Situation Podcast Network. Only Vans, a Texas country music pod with rock star host Bree Bagwell, recently welcomed Matt Hillier.
You sang a song nobody had ever heard, and you kept going, come on, everybody, sing it with me.
You know the words.
You know the words. It was the best.
On Basic Folk, honest conversations with folk musicians, myself and co-host Lizzie Noh recently featured John Moreland.
Some of the lyrics are like, you seem to know some things you must have overheard. It sounds like it's talking about a lover. A couple minutes into the song, he's talking about a smartphone, and it just creeped me out so hard that I got a flip phone too.
Oh, wow. And finally, the String Dusters' Travis Book is hosting the Travis Book Happy Hour, live music and conversation from guests like Trey Hensley.
Just listening to Earl Scruggs play the banjo or play the guitar, you always knew it was him. There was always those people that played, and you immediately, within a few seconds of hearing their instrument, knew it was them.
Hear it all and more on the Bluegrass Situation Podcast Network or wherever you get podcasts. Hello, and welcome to Basic Folk, where we have honest conversations with folk musicians on the Bluegrass Situation Podcast Network. It's me, Cindy. Hiya. Here we are, a very big day in Basic Folk land. Amos Lee is on the pod. Before we get into that, let's talk about some stuff. Have you signed up for Basic Folk's newsletter? It's a once-a-month email that lets you know what's going on with your favorite little folk podcast. Although, there are some pretty great folk podcasts out there now. I hope that I am amongst your favorites. If you want to sign up for our newsletter, stay in touch. You can do so at the link in the show notes, or you can go to our website, basicfolk.com. That's also where, if you are so inclined, you can make a contribution and support us with maybe a $5 a month contribution. It's very easy to do. It really helps keep the train on the tracks here, so to speak. Basicfolk.com is where you can make your contribution. There is also a link in the show notes to do that as well. You can follow us on social media. We are on Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, and YouTube at Basic Folk Pod. And that just about does it. Okay, on with the show. Amos Lee. Throughout his music career, singer-songwriter Amos Lee has cultivated a large female fan base and also owes a lot of his early start to Norah Jones, also a female. He's about to hit the road co-headlining with folk music and queer icons, the Indigo Girls. In our conversation, he talks about the atmosphere he's going for in concert, and it's not a very bro-centered vibe. His latest album, Transmissions, further proves his case with a gorgeous sonic palette that includes country music, indie folk, folk rock, and acoustic music sounds. Recorded with his longtime band in a studio in rural Marlborough, New York, the songs came out as warm as the reclaimed church wood the studio was built out of. Amos dives into topics like how he feels about kids, to his work with cancer patients, to the benefits of caring for your mental health and music. He touches on anxiety and overstimulation, mostly prompted by my anxiety, and overcoming adversity. He also talks about being a mentor for the Black Opry residency last year at WXPN in his hometown of Philadelphia, and explains what a hoagie mouth is. I was just delighted speaking with Amos Lee. Hope you enjoy this one and check out his new album, Transmissions. From the release, we'll hear a clip of Hold On Tight, and then we'll get to our conversation with Amos Lee on Basic Folk.
Looking for a fight. We are
right, Amos Lee, we're getting right into it. I've got a lot of questions about your whole life and your new album.
Oh, wow. That's a lot.
Yeah. It's going to be great. So thank you for talking to me and welcome to Basic Folk.
Happy to be here.
Before there was music, Amos, there was basketball for you. So what is your basketball story? It sounds like you had like big basketball dreams. Mm. And also, how do you try to stay connected with the sport?
Oh, you know, I grew up playing sports a lot. I think that there was like a draw for me. Nobody in my family really plays sports or music, and I wasn't really drawn to music early in my life. I don't really know if it's just an access point. Like there's a ball around and you see kids playing on the street. And I think there's something to this, because if you think about Cajun communities in Louisiana, there's music everywhere. Like if I went somewhere where there were people playing music just outside, like in New Orleans, I probably would have started playing music much earlier in my life, but I didn't have an access point. I didn't have music schools. Nobody in my household was playing music. We moved around a lot. I didn't have instruments. But in sports, there was always like a kid playing on the street or a stickball in the schoolyard or something. So I was drawn to that. It was social. I felt connected to other people. And for me, that was always sort of a thing because I was an only child and raised by a single mom who was working a lot. So I often felt kind of maybe removed or disconnected. And sports was a way for me to like be social and connected to people. And basketball for me was just the one that kind of made the most sense. It required the least amount of equipment, which was good. It's just a ball,
right?
Which is good. It's sort of like soccer in that way. You don't have to buy a bunch of gear and do a bunch of stuff. You just show up. As you know, trying to connect me to this podcast, it's difficult for me to buy things and figure them out. So a ball and a hoop was good for me, a lot like a guitar and a microphone is good for me. Mm-hmm. But yeah, sure. I mean, every kid has some kind of dream, right? I mean, maybe not anymore, but they did when I was young. But basketball was just a thing that I fell in love with. And there was a sort of a drama to it all. You know, there's a drama to sports, and that's sort of what keeps me interested, is the stories and it's the soap opera mentality thing. And I quickly learned that dreams are often just, you know, things that are full of pain. And that is just the truth. There's also a lot of beauty in them and fun and experience and learning and all that good stuff. But basketball was just nonstop, like disappointment and pain. And music for me has been less. There's been some of that, but it's not been nearly as much. Not as constant and not as soul crushing. I wasn't very good at basketball either. Like I was probably average. I did way more work than you should have to be average, but I was probably average. But yeah, I guess I did have dreams of that, but they quickly faded when I realized that that was just not a thing that was going to happen. You know, I really do admire, though, like I know a lot of people who are good basketball players who may not make it to the NBA, but they play in Europe or in other countries, and they grind it out so hard. And I honestly really admire that. It's not just because it's the dream and the willingness to stick by the things that you love, but also like the practicality of it and the constance of it. It's a lot like touring. Like if you're a touring musician, you may not be playing arenas and stadiums and all that jive, but you consistently and constantly work. Maybe you're playing small clubs. Maybe you're sticking with open mics until you can make a living. I mean, I know that a lot of that has changed with the internet and the way that you can just become an instant star overnight, which feels pretty actually new to me. Like I know that things like that have happened, but nowadays it's like, oh, actually instant. You have one album out and you're playing stadiums. That is not a thing that really happened before. And the algorithm mindset is really strong right now. And yeah. they're just feeding. And people are eating. And so anyway, in the sports analogy, I think that the dream was real for me, but it wasn't sustainable. Like there was no sustainability in that way for me. And I'm kind of glad that I recognized it when I did. But yeah, it was painful.
Yeah. Wow. So, wow. There's so much there. Did you see the New Yorker article recently? Why I finally quit Spotify?
No, I don't read anything except for books. You know what I'm reading right now that's awesome is Mark Lanegan's autobiography.
Oh, is it?
It's really interesting and good. Yeah, it's called
Talent.
Yeah, Sing Backwards and Weep. And it kind of brings you, and you want to talk about the opposite of all of that, it's Mark Lanegan. And really the 90s. And a reason why I wanted to read it, and I'm sorry for just, I really feel like I'm just talking over you and I apologize, but I just want to make this one point. The reason I really wanted to read it was to find out what it was like for a musician coming into their own in the late 80s and early 90s and to see kind of like the trajectory of someone who I really admire as an artist and what they had to go through. Now, he went through a lot of stuff that was, you know, demon beaten, but he also was just like dedicated to this thing and he couldn't quite find the answers early on with the Screaming Trees and was making his solo records. It's kind of like Elliott Smith a little bit, where they were in a band and it wasn't really working. And then they decided, I just want to do this other thing. So anyway, sorry, I didn't read that only because I don't really read a lot of stuff like that.
The main point that I took away from the article is that companies like streaming companies, instead of doing like a customer first approach to the way that we listen to music on their services, it's a corporate first, like company first approach, you know, so whatever makes them the most profit, whatever gets the user to stay on the platform more. And that's going all over the place online with Facebook and Instagram and everything that uses an algorithm. It just was kind of nuts, you know, to actually, you know, read that in print and be like, oh, yeah, it's like so true.
Yeah. Well, that's their entire model is to keep you engaged and to usurp your attention space. And and that's, I mean, I think there's a space for, obviously, there's a bunch of ways it works. It's good for artists in a way because it does the discovery part of it is really beautiful and wonderful. I think the bigger questions that we have to ask ourselves as a species, though, is like, is this good for us? Is this good for our species? Is this a way that we're kind of evolving? And is it a place for art to really thrive? Or is it just a place for commerce to explode? I don't really know. And maybe there are people who would disagree with me on that. And I'm not really here to like yuck anybody's yum. I'm just mostly here to kind of tell you my story and my side of it and the things that I care about. But I don't think I don't think I speak for really anybody. I think I speak for me and my particular take on this moment in time.
Mm-hmm. That reminds me of my next question, which it doesn't remind me at all. I'm just trying to segue.
That's
into
fine.
The next question.
you don't even have to. You can be ADHD as hell because that's how I am.
Well, two musicians who had a huge impact on you are John Prine and Bill Withers, who both died right around the same time.
They did.
And you were so impacted that you couldn't listen to them in the aftermath of their deaths. Instead, you turned to artists like Chet Baker, who you actually made a tribute album of, artists like Fats Waller for Solace.
Yeah.
What has been your experience of like feeling safety in music for yourself and in thinking about the fact that many others have felt safe in your music?
I'm glad that there's some kind of connection there for people. That's kind of a big part of it. I kind of feel a lot of ways with music. I mean, when I started out, music was this kind of like being released into the wild for the first time. Like if you're a bird in a cage and all of a sudden you're like your owner's like, okay, go. And you're like, whoa, this is amazing. I've never experienced feelings like this before. I've also never been kind of this terrified of everything, because when you listen to stuff like John Coltrane live at the Village Vanguard, or Ali Akbar Khan, Traditional Music of India, or Donny Hathaway live, these records that are, I didn't even know music could do that. I really didn't. Like, I mostly grew up, and I'm not, I love 90s R&B. It's my thing. I also really love singer-songwriter music, but the depths that somebody like Eric Dolphy got to, and Coltrane got to, and Ali Akbar Khan and folks like that, just, I couldn't fathom that that was music. To me, it felt so much deeper than just like, you know, picking up a guitar and being like, and all that. So it's not just safety for me. Like, there's a lot of exploration. There's a lot of really deep discomfort in pursuing this as a kind of career, especially as an art form. It's just beautiful and fun at home. You know, that is a place where a lot of times when maybe I'm having just a really rough time in my life, I'll pick up a guitar and be like, all right, I'm good. Like, I don't have to completely unravel here. It brings me back to a place where I feel connected to the world. I think that my therapist, sorry, every time I say my therapist, I have to drink. I think my therapist would say I'm dissociating, and then music brings me back. And that is kind of what happens. Mm-hmm. But I...
Can you go into a little deeper of like what it feels like when you are, when music is bringing you back?
Yeah, there's just kind of like, do you meditate or do yoga or anything like that? You know that feeling that your brain has when you're just like, you're just totally scrambled and you meditate and all of a sudden you're like, all right, I'm good. I'm like back to stage one or whatever it might be. Mm-hmm. It just kind of, my nervous system calms down a lot when I get into a song, because I like meditation, you kind of get into this timeless space where you're just focusing on the moment. The outside world is not like barraging you with everything that it wants to barrage you with. And you're just in a moment with the thing that you love. It's a lot like being, you know, when I'm writing songs, especially when I'm in a moment that feels really good to me, it does feel like being with a lover or being with someone you just feel really loved by. It doesn't have to be like physical romantic love. It could just be like love. Because it feels just very, I don't know if I would use the word safe, because there's also other sides of music that are multidimensional. But I like that you think that other people find that kind of solace in the music. I've sort of sought that out at times with music, but I also like to really discover stuff that doesn't make me feel like I feel already. I mean, I like to go into the depths of shit with music. Like, I want to go all the way down. I want to ocean gate that shit, you know, like Elliott Smith, especially. Like, there are times when I listen to him and I'm just like, I don't want to deal with the world at all. I want to go all the way down and I want to be with Elliot. And there are other people like that too. But, you know, it just depends on the word safety. Like, is that safe? Am I going into this like depressive state that feels good to me? Yeah, probably to an extent. Depression has always felt kind of safe to me. It's always been a safe space.
Yeah, I think sometimes I'm a pretty anxious person and I feel like anxiety feels like comfortable to me. Like, okay, we're in a panic mode here and everything is great and I feel at home in this moment.
Yeah, that's like the chaos response. Your brain is going like, yeah, this is good. But every part, all your other parts are like, nah, this ain't good.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you about children, kids. Many years ago, you were a second grade teacher and you said, I wasn't a very good teacher. I was just a little too abstract with the kids. However, doing a lot of research on you, doing a deep dive, there are some kids that are huge fans of yours. For example, I watched an interview with a 7-year-old who recently got to sing on stage with you.
Oh, yeah, that kid was cool.
So pumped. He was so cool. He was like, holy guacamole. I don't know. It was really good.
Yeah, he
really
was cool. He did a good job, too.
Wow.
He did a really good job.
You've also participated in pediatric patient cancer care. I saw you did Musicians on Call live stream with a couple of young girls who were asking you questions, and they were just like really locked in. It was really impressive that these kids are such fans of yours. How has it been to connect with kids through your music? Like, have you always liked kids, and how has music changed your relationship to kids?
I think that kid's name was Mason, if I remember right, the 7-year-old. I think his name was Mason. I mean, the reason why I went into teaching elementary education, which is what I got my minor in college, and I did my student teaching, was because I wanted to give back to kids, or really the world. But I felt like, you know, sometimes we need, I remember my kindergarten teacher was a huge influence on me. She was amazing. This woman named Charlotte. And I think we need advocates. We need people who see us, especially sometimes when, you know, even kids are complicated. They're really complex emotional beings. A lot of people are like, oh, kids are cute. Teaching second grade is cute. And I'm like, no, it's not actually cute. It's a lot of things. There's cuteness. There's also intensity. There's anger. There's sadness. There's a lot of emotions. I would say there's big feelings. And I think the cool thing about connecting with kids is that there are big feelings. They'll be honest most of the time. I don't think kids are always honest, and any parent will tell you that. They're figuring out what boundaries are, like with honesty and with storytelling and with their own sense of comfort and safety in a relationship with a parent, you know? But with me, music has always been a place to connect with people. And something that's happened over the years for me is when I started out in like 2003 playing open mics, or 2002, maybe that was, I was just kind of like having fun. It was really just fun. And, you know, I was sorting through like romance and friendships and making it or whatever the hell that was. I didn't even care about that, to be honest with you. But, I was sorting through a lot of stuff, and it was all new and exciting and fun. And then you do it for like 10 years and the grind gets to you, and the grind hits you really hard, and you're like, okay, why am I doing this? Like, this life, despite what you think, like, everybody's job is hard, right? Every job is hard. Every single person's job is hard. There's nobody who's like, my job is always easy. That's what the money's for, right, Don? But the other parts of it are...
Which Don are you talking to?
Don Draper.
No. Oh, it's a Mad Men reference.
Yeah.
Oh.
So, yeah, he says, that's what the money's for. But, you know, at a point, there has to be other stuff. Because, first of all, if you're playing music, you're probably not going to make money in the beginning, which I didn't. But then you have to be like, okay, this grind is intense. Like, the travel is a lot. The constantly being on stage as an introverted person, honestly, is a lot. I don't love that part of it all the time. But I do love the part, like you said, where I can see people in the crowd feeling it. And I'm like, all right, this is good. This can be my life's work. I can do this. But there are other places I want to go with it that give me even more connection to people. That's the stuff like with pediatric cancer, or just like general, like out of the box stuff that isn't just me on stage singing to a room of people. Like, I like the singularity of the experience. Like, that kid coming on stage being like, holy guacamole, that was fun and cool. That makes me feel good about, like, this thing that I do. Because I love the band people. My band members are amazing. I love them. I adore what they do. I can't believe how much they give every single night. And the audience members, just like, they're still showing up, which is like wild to me. But there's still another place I want to go to, because it is so abstract sometimes to be on stage and to be singing to a room of people you can't really even see a lot of the times, because the lights are blinding. And if you think about how obsessed we are with scale in our culture, like, the artists that we most kind of like admire are the people playing these mostly abstract, very abstract experiences. Okay, how do you not feel completely disconnected from the world when that's your experience every day? So what I'm trying to do is lessen the gap. I want to bring it closer to like the humanity that we are, but where all of this started, which is just communal stuff that was probably pretty ritualistic, maybe fun, maybe a lot of gaiety, a lot of spontaneity, you know, a little silly, a little sad, all of that stuff. That's the stuff that I like.
I would say as much gaiety as possible.
Agreed. Bring the gaiety, all of the gaiety. Let's have all of it back.
I wanted to ask you a little bit more about working with cancer patients. So we mentioned Musicians on Call, which is this wonderful nonprofit that you've worked with for 20-ish years.
Yeah, it's been a minute.
Your mom has had bouts of cancer as well.
Oh, yeah.
How has being around cancer patients impacted the way you like perceive the world, and how has it helped you with your mom's cancer journey?
I've worked with a bunch of people over the years, and there's a lot of beautiful stories. Like the show that Mason was singing at in Grand Rapids, there's a family who I've been known for a bunch of years, actually through the Melodic Caring Project, which is another organization that I work with in Portland. And there's another great one, actually they're in Seattle. There's another great one called Joy RX, which is in Portland. So I work with a bunch of organizations over all over the country. There's a young gal who has been coming to my shows since, I don't know, probably she was maybe 6 or 7 years old. She's 13 now, I think 14, somewhere in that realm. And she's had cancer since she was 6 months old. So, and she's wonderful, like a really great kid. And we worked on one of her songs backstage. I just have a lot of respect and admiration for the families who are constantly going through the grind of this uncertainty. I mean, all of our existences are pretty uncertain. Like, we're all in this very tenuous state. And no, there's no one who knows that more than maybe Lily or some of these other kids that I've worked with over the years, some of whom haven't made it through and have passed on. And those stories really impact me deeply because, you know, you see them and you see how the suffering is. And a lot of times in our, maybe in our entertainment or in our escapes, like a lot of people I think use music to escape, especially now there's so much of that like cosplay stuff going on, they don't really want that. They don't really want that like intense reality, and I don't really mind it. I kind of want to embrace it. There's another family who I know pretty well at this point, who their daughter had got cancer and passed away in 2019. And she was such a cool kid, like amazing person. And her sister got married last month And I went.
Is this the Carry You On?
Yeah, I went and played. Yeah. Well, she's not a twin. She's a couple years younger, but They're close. They're close in age.
How did I make them twins in my mind?
I don't know. They're soul twins. They love like that. And I just, you know, those people, they stay with you in your heart. And, you know, I'm not really sure how it impacted my mom's thing, because my mom got cancer before I really even played music. And when your family member's going through it, like you're in it. Like, you're there for the chemo. You know, you're there with when their blood pressure goes crazy because of the chemo. You're there when their hair's falling out and their teeth are falling out and their mouth has sores. I mean, look, how deep do you want to go down this? Because I know it well. It's heart-wrenching stuff. And the way that we exist together is, you know, it's a big lift. It's a big lift. And that's why, when you tell me like a few questions ago that there are people who are finding safety in the music, I'm really grateful for that, because I want to be part of their healing journey and their connection and their community and all of the good stuff. Like I want to be a part of that. That to me is that's kind of the most important point for me in all of this, is the connection and the community and the way that I feel through my songs is maybe the way someone else feels sometimes is wild to me.
Have you ever thought about writing a book?
Oh God. I don't know if I could finish a book. I don't know if I could. I think I would get so, like, you hear how my brain works. I get so lost in stuff.
There's so much good stuff in there.
In the noggin?
In the noggin.
There's a lot of nogginin' happening up in here.
All right, Amos, I want to talk about women.
Oh, God.
You have a lot of women and non-men fans. Here's what I've noticed.
God.
from working with Norah Jones in the early part of your career. You opened for her. She's on your record.
I sure did.
You worked with her producer on your first record. Mm-hmm. Now you're co-headlining with Indigo Girls this year. So it kind of seems like women have played a unique role in your music. And it seems to me like you've had a very feminine career. How have you experienced the importance of women and femininity throughout your career in music?
I mean, I love that. I think that's a beautiful observation, and I hope it's true. I mean, you're correct that I don't have a bunch of bro fans. I wouldn't be mad at it if they wanted to come out, but it's not that kind of hang. You know, and it's probably bad for me to say that, because it's probably not going to get me any new fans, but it's just not that kind of thing. I went to see the Indigo Girls in San Diego a few years ago. I can't remember what year anything is anymore. The COVID stuff I have no idea what year it was. It could have been 2019. It could have been 2021. I don't remember. But I went to see them, and I went down this. I usually go to shows by myself. I promise you, I'm answering your question. I usually go to shows by myself because I really enjoy kind of just being there, like not really having to entertain anybody or give my attention to anyone else. So I'm at this show, and I'm listening to these incredible songs, and I'm looking at the audience. And I'm like, this is a safe space for people. And it also has been a safe space for people for so many years. Like, I think about the Indigo Girls from the 90s being like openly gay pop artists in the 90s.
Top 40 radio.
From the South. Like, are you talking about total anomalous brilliance that transcends all things? Yeah. I think so. I think the Indigo Girls are probably one of, I also think Ani DiFranco is in the same boat where it's like some of the most underrated people. And I'm glad the Indigo Girls got some flowers with the Barbie stuff, because those songs, the harmonies, the connection, the topics, they'll write about everything. They write about everything. I adore them. I adore them. And I've always been a fan from the very beginning. As a songwriter, I mean, my first two big influences from a harmony standpoint were Boyz II Men and the Indigo Girls.
Yeah.
Those are the two people that I was like, that's what harmony should be. Anyway, also Lucinda Williams has been a huge influence on me. Mm-hmm. Bonnie Raitt is a huge influence on me. Nora is an amazing artist who I've been hugely influenced by. I mean, I listened to her sing every night for 2 years and just in total awe of her.
What a cool career she's had.
Because she's just a special person and she's always been that way. Like when we signed to the same record label, we both had the same instinct, which is, I don't know, like these people seem cool and we want to make music. And that's and she had a diamond record and still said, I don't know, I just want to make music. She's an amazing person. You know, but then, you know, there are a lot of women in my path. I was, you know, like I said, largely influenced from an early age, mostly by women. Mostly felt comfortable being raised by women. My mom, my aunts, my grandmother, those were the people who were really around me. I can't really answer the thing about, like, I don't really know the direct correlation or why things are the way they are. I mean, what part of femininity presents itself in my music that feels more connected? I don't know. I love that it does. I am just, I'm a little uncertain of that part. I mean, John Prine was a huge influence. Bill Withers was a huge influence. I grew up mostly listening to hip hop, which was not, you know, super cool to women in the 90s at all. From a lyrical standpoint, not everybody, obviously, there's a lot of amazing stuff, but there was a lot of, you know, I wasn't listening to all that either. You know, I was listening to, like, you know, stuff where my mom would be like, what is this? You know, it wasn't the cussing, it was the misogyny that she was most pissed off about.
Oh, yeah.
There were a few tunes, and it's not all hip hop, and I'm not here crapping. I love hip hop. Don't get me wrong. But, you know, it's interesting because I feel like the first song I really connected with and wrote, I mean, I'd written songs from like the second I picked a guitar up, but Arms of a Woman was always the song that was like, okay, that feels like a song to me.
I feel like that was the song that most people first heard of you. And it just kind of feels like that song maybe just like set the tone. Like, hey guys, here's what I'm about.
Yeah. There's a lot to it. There's a lot of things that I feel about that. And you know, over the years I've thought a lot about what that song means and like, what is it about? Because honestly, at the time, I think I wrote that when I was 19, I didn't have any girlfriend. I didn't have anybody I was even being comforted by. I was just on an air mattress on the floor of a really crusty apartment writing a song because I'd been listening to a lot of Otis Redding and I wanted to write a song and that came out. So, you know, there's a lot to think about when I consider your question. And so I'm really trying to like mine through like what the definition of femininity is in our culture. Like, I think that's part of the problem is how we define things and how we define masculinity more than femininity. And I think our definitions of masculinity are outdated. And I think they're, I think they can be a little not inclusive. Let's put it that way. And I think sometimes like if you define me, and this is obviously off topic, but if you say to me, well, there's a beautiful part of you that's influenced by and presented as feminine, I feel a compliment. But if I said to you, you're kind of masculine, I don't know, would you take that as a compliment?
No.
Right. So these words that we use for these concepts, I don't struggle with them, but I don't quite know if they're equal. I don't know if they're, and obviously for good reasons that we have these misnomers and miseducation about what, as we say, gender and the way that we're engendering words about like masculine and feminine. And are they way less binary than we think? Yeah, of course. Like that's the whole point. That's why this new generation is going like, nah, like I'm not going there. So I think about it in those ways. And we could obviously have like a pretty like hour long podcast about how we're engendering language and what we're talking about when we say feminine and masculine, and where we, how music especially is really blurs the lines in all of the ways. Mm-hmm. And I really love that. I love the question, to be honest with you. I really do love the question. I like the thought of it. I like the depth of it. I don't know if I have a great like soundbite answer for it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the thing. I feel like talking to you, it seems as though every question I ask you could be like its own podcast episode.
Yeah, well, I think it could be. I think that's why so many, if people are doing things correct, if people are actually having conversations, mm-hmm. and there are good, like you've done your research, you've done a lot of like really solid, in-depth, thoughtful research. If you do all of that and you come to me with those questions and I'm giving you 10 second answers, well, then I'm not really giving you much thought. I'm not meeting you where you're meeting me. Now, if you had come with questions that were, I just want a 10 second answer, I would have given you 10 second answers, but you didn't.
Let's talk about this record, Transmissions, on your new label, Hoagie Mouth. And you're wearing the sweatshirt.
I got to promote the swag, man. I don't promote myself. I got to promote my brand.
Hoagie Mouth, will the merch be available at the shows for Hoagie Mouth?
Yeah, we usually sell it. Yeah, there's only like a couple things. There's a hoodie, there's a shirt, there's a hat and socks.
That's enough.
Yeah, you have a whole
Maybe
outfit.
Maybe a tote.
Yeah, there is a tote.
Or like one of those Yeti tumblers.
Oh, yeah, that would be good. Yeah.
I'm in the market for one of those.
Okay. I got you. That's a good idea.
Are you Hoagie Mouth? Who is Hoagie Mouth?
Am I Hoagie Mouth? Hoagie Mouth is an accent in Philadelphia. It's like the Philly accent.
Could you give us a
yeah,
couple
it's like,
lines?
Yeah, it's like when you talk like that. It's like, what are you doing a podcast for, man? Yeah, I mean, you got a job, dude? Something like that.
The words plastic and water are
plastic,
often...
plastic and water.
Water.
Yeah, water. Yeah, if you say it like W-I-T-T-U-R, witter.
Witter. Witter.
Yeah, there you go. That's it. You did good.
Okay. This is a great record. Oh, I love it.
Thanks.
I have a couple of questions about different songs, and they're not in order because
that's
I got
fine.
A stream of the record that went by the time this
I
episode
don't care.
Is out now.
Yeah, I don't
It
care.
Seems as though, like, when I was trying to, I got sent the track by track, the lyrics, and the stream, and none of them were in the same order, and I thought, here we go. This is great.
Unbelievable. Like, I worked for, like, way too long sequencing the record, and it's the dumbest thing you could possibly spend your time on. It's like
I read that. I read about that you spent a long time, and then I saw the way that everything was different ordered, and there were even song lyrics in there that aren't on the record. So we'll have to wait for the special edition version of the record to come out.
Why? Oh my God.
Well, the song "Hold On Tight." Oh, what a great song! I was listening to that and thinking about this. I think it's fair to say that a lot of your songs are about people and the human experience. Mm. I've heard you call yourself a shy person, but there is such a clear, intense love for other people.
Mm.
So what has that looked like living alongside each other for you?
In this song, you mean? Being shy.
Being shy and also loving people.
I don't even know if I would call myself shy. I would call myself kind of...
You called yourself shy earlier in
reclusive.
The interview.
I would probably go further than saying shy. I'd say reclusive. I don't really think that I'm shy when I'm comfortable. And I think that shyness can be a decision. But I don't thrive in hyper social situations. Let's put it that way. I feel very overwhelmed. I mean, that's the thing about music. Like you can, or being a writer really, or an artist of any kind, frankly, a painter, you can observe and digest the things around you through this form that you've chosen. And the form that I've chosen is a social one. And it's been a lot of things to play music, to have this relationship with the world where you are kind of, you're in it and you're separate from it. I mean, that's the way I've lived most of my life anyway, kind of like observing, but I think you can love people and not be like engaged in some kind of like crazy, you know, Instagrammable moment where you're like just smiling and, you know, whatever, like, like I can just love you quietly and not on the books, you know, mm-hmm. I like to love people off the books. But I also like to love them on the books when I can. I'm learning to love people on the books more. That hasn't always come very naturally to me.
Yeah. Oh, I like that. You're also someone who's worked on your mental health over the years, and that comes out in some of the songs on the album. And as someone who
You think it's going to be wait for the next record. That's going to be the real mental health stuff. Because I've been in.
Should I hold my
therapy.
Mental health question? Until the next record?
No, bring it on.
Okay, great. So as someone who wants to help people, after being around so many friends and family members that experience mental health issues and experiencing them yourself, what have you discovered about how to help in those type of mental health, let's call them situations?
I mean, listening is probably the first place to start. Offering people a safe place to talk to you and really just giving them the grace of being like, you make sense. Like, there's nothing broken about you. You make sense. All of the things that you're feeling happened and there's a reason why you feel the way you feel. You're not crazy. You're not, again, broken. There was nothing born wrong in you. The experiences that you had led you to this place. And, you know, in some cases, there are things happening in a brain that are creating, you know, real distress that isn't just talk. You can't just talk it out. A safe space won't really make it any better. But a lot of people just want to be understood. They want to be, I know for me, it's nice to just hear from somebody, hey, it's okay. Like you're good here. Like I don't want to just like this one part of you. I like all of you. And yeah, sometimes maybe you're a little edgy and difficult. And maybe sometimes you're a little emotional, but oftentimes I just feel like so many people are only lovable when they're the one thing that people like them to be. And so they tailor their life to be this one thing because that's where they feel accepted. And so these other parts of them just get like pushed off into the shadows and into the places where they become other stuff. So I don't know. Compassion, I think, is helpful. Being thoughtful, listening, asking good questions. But then also there's just the like, not judging people so harshly. Cause I think it's another thing. It's like, we're such harsh judges. There's such an idea that like there's hard rights and wrongs, and there's no like, you know, there's no place in between where we can just kind of feel like, well, you know, I ran the red light. I just didn't feel like sitting at it. Okay, cool. There was nobody around. That's fine. You know, we do live in the echoes of the puritanical. And I think that those, not even the echoes, like there's a portion of people that really want us to feel judged on a daily basis and want us to acquiesce to their idea of right and wrong, of righteousness and condemnation. And I just really disagree with those people. Mm-hmm. I really do. I really disagree. And I think that there's a beautiful space where people can exist together and feel like they're accepted, but not at the defeat of people who don't share all of their views. I just disagree with that. Hmm.
The way this album is made, I think, is hugely important to the story. So it says you return to an old school style of recording, working with your longtime band in rural Marlboro, New York.
Oh, I like those two words together. Rural Marlboro.
Yeah, thank you. Built by your drummer, Lee Falco, and his dad out of reclaimed wood from an old church.
Yeah.
Creepy and cool. Yeah. Everyone in your band and band adjacent is very close. How did it feel when you put your closest musical collaborators in a scene like this? Like, how did the setting impact everyone's connection to one another?
I mean, the good thing is they already love each other, so it's easier. All those folks that were in that room, just they care for each other. They're family. They're like family up there in upstate New York. And Jaron came by and a couple other people popped in. But, you know, a lot of it was really purposefully set up to be connected and to be like in the real world. There's a lot of ways to record right now. And I don't really have a problem with any of them. I think they're all cool. I just particularly wanted to be in a room with people again and to experience the like creative joy that happens when people are sharing ideas. Mm-hmm. That was a thing I really missed. Especially post COVID, where like there was so much isolation, I really wanted to just be in a beautiful studio with beautiful people and exploring ideas and letting the best idea win. And it always did with these people, but they're honestly, those, all of the people involved on this record are such beautiful folks.
I want to sidebar here and say that Jaron is like best friends with a friend of mine, Chris O'Brien.
Oh yeah. I know Chris.
Yeah.
Is Chris in Boston, right?
He lives in Boston.
He was going to be a lawyer, and now he's a teacher?
I think he is a lawyer.
Oh, he's a lawyer. Okay, cool.
I text him my law questions.
Oh, God, okay.
And I text him recommendations for law TV shows that I find.
Oh, yeah. Cool.
And yeah. About Amos Lee.
Oh, far
Those
out.
Are the three things we text about.
Yeah, he's a good dude. I knew Chris before he was a lawyer. He was a singer-songwriter.
Yeah, really great one.
Yeah, and we played some shows together. I think he played Passim a few times. There was definitely a place that we played. He used to hold, if I remember correctly, he used to hold this like kind of variety night in Boston in this back room of this bar. I can't remember the name of it.
The Burin?
That's it, the Burin. Yeah. Yeah. We played at the Burin a few times.
I'd like to have him on the podcast as a singer, songwriter, lawyer, you know, really get into the law.
I mean, honestly, it's a very interesting story. And he's a very talented songwriter. Does he still write? Do you know? Mm-hmm.
Yes.
He does.
Yeah, I think he was working on a record.
Cool.
Yeah. The other sidebar I have for you, this is the middle of the episode where we talk about, I get to talk about my Amos Lee stories. The other one I have is I was an intern at WBOS in Boston in the early O's. I was like probably 20 years old. And I was talking with the, you were there and Mootloo was there. Mm. And I was like, I was trying to talk to like the boss. I was like, oh, look, that's Mootloo, who I told you about. I was trying to like be impressive to her, being like, I know about I know about a lot of music. Right. And then you looked at me and you go, do you heart him?
Yeah, that's
and I was like, well put. Yeah. Deserved.
He's my boy, dude. That guy's the best. I love him. He's one of my oldest and dearest buds. You should have him on. He's got a lot to say. He's a cool guy.
Great. Let's get him on. Okay. I want to ask you one more question. I had a bunch of questions, but I feel like we got to wrap it up. So let me know if you don't want to answer this question. You participated as a mentor during WXPN's Black Opry residency last year, March of 2023. So five up and coming musicians who are Black spent the week at WXPN in Philly, hanging out, collaborating with each other, doing song swaps, and learning from seasoned musicians like yourself and also country singer Reese Palmer. Two questions, like, why was it important for you to serve as a mentor for the Black Opry? And what is it like to see more Black and brown faces in the folk, country, and roots adjacent scene?
I just think it's just a cool thing. Like, I'm here for everybody. Like, play music. Who cares? Honestly, who cares about genre? To me, I don't really think much about it. I think it's cool that there's kind of getting back to where music started, you know, like when there weren't such big walls, genre walls that we put just for like, you know, really like segregating music buying is kind of what genre started as. And I like that that's going away. And then we're just like, no, everybody just playing music doesn't really have to be this or that or the other. I thought that project was cool and interesting, and the songwriters were great. They were like beautiful, man. Just a beautiful day. And I just got up there and kind of yammered on like this, which is sort of a thing that I do. I don't have a lot of like wisdom to impart to people on their journeys. I really don't. I have my experience that I can share, but I don't really know that anybody would or wouldn't want to like kind of have the career that I've had. I think that there's an ambition that most artists have that is bigger than what I am. Like I can play theaters and clubs and stuff and be happy to do it, but it's not the like, everything's all set. You're playing huge places and getting huge guarantees all the time. Like I do well, I'm fine. I don't know that if someone were to set up a career, they'd be like, I want to do that. Mm. So I think I've had some opportunities that I've really done well with, and I've had some opportunities I haven't done that well with. I think that I'm not a great self-promoter. I think I'm not a very active person on social media, which I probably could be. I think that
Here's where I'd argue with you.
Okay.
I feel like you're somebody who has achieved a career in music. You're able to pay your bills and you're able to express yourself artistically and keep true to who you are as a person. I think that in and of itself is worthy of hearing from as a young aspiring artist, you know, because as we were talking about earlier, we're living in this like late stage capitalistic world where it's so easy to get lost in the TikToks and the algorithm.
Yeah. Yeah. I, I, I do have some concerns there. You know, this is our concern, dude. I do have some concerns.
Lebowski.
There. Yeah, that's right. Good job. I do have some concerns there. And yeah, I mean, but that would be my advice to people. And it is the cool thing too about the Black Opry is like, just be yourself. Like,
yeah.
You don't have to fit into anything. You don't have to be this or that. It doesn't matter that people are going, oh, that's unusual. It's like, yeah, well, good. I want it to be unusual because that's what being genuine usually is.
Yeah. All right, Amos, do you want to do a lightning round Philly style?
Okay, let's do it.
All right. Who's your favorite Philly sports mascot?
The Fanatic. There's not even a question about that. I don't even recognize any other mascot.
Oh, all right. Where is the best Philly coffee?
Let's see. What would the best be? There's a few places that are really good. I mean, the one I go to the most is Ultimo because it's just kind of where I'm usually walking around. But there are so many really good places. There's a ton of good roasters in Philly that are wonderful.
Cool. Should they have moved the Rocky statue?
Where did they move it to? The Art Museum. It's at the Art Museum now. Yeah, because
I moved it away from the Art Museum and into its own area.
Yeah, well, they might have moved it off the stairs. I thought it was in front of the Spectrum before, and now it's like the Art Museum, which to me, the weirdest part of all of this is that we have this incredible Art Museum. Like one of the, I think it's the first art museum ever built. It's beautiful. It's like this incredible passage in Philadelphia that was sort of Ben Franklin, I think, had this kind of thought that it could be like the Champs-Élysées and this whole beautiful avenue that is at the top of it is this art museum that overlooks the city. And the art museum that we have is absolutely stunning and incredible. And next to it, there's the statue of a fake boxer that like so many tourists are lining up to take a picture with. And I'm just like, this is so very Philly to me. Like, it's so bizarre. But I don't know. I think it's okay where it is. I understand why they moved it there because the iconic scene is Rocky running up the art museum steps. But I don't know. It's kind of weird to me.
What was the first Philly concert you attended that you can remember?
That I can remember. I didn't go to any concerts really as a kid. It's a great band, but it's not like a cool Philly story. I think I saw the Allman Brothers one time, like on the riverfront. But I wasn't a big concert goer.
Lame answer.
Yeah, that's just the truth.
Sometimes the truth is lame.
Hey.
This is the last question. What Philly restaurant are you taking your family to dinner?
There's a bunch of them. I'm going to say this a lot of times because I do have a lot of favorites. And I think the food scene in Philadelphia is very, very good right now. Like, amazing, actually. And I travel to pretty much every big city. The go-to that I usually go to is this place called Vernick, which I really love. Just cool folks, good food, good staff. It's like comfortable. It's quiet. It's really well done. Just a great place. My family doesn't care about fancy restaurants. My family likes diners, honestly.
Right. So are you taking them to the diner?
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, I love diners. I like just whatever, honestly. Like I'll take my mom likes going to whatever's close and easy, you know, like she'll go to, you know, Seasons 52 or whatever it's called, or the Bonefish Grill, but we go to like Ponzio's a lot, you know, the diners. Like my family doesn't
care.
That
sounds like such a diner, Ponzio's.
Ponzio's, yeah. Ponzio's and all of those diners. But, you know, sometimes at night I want to like have a nice drink and chill and like just have some space to just kind of think. And when I'm in a diner, I just want to eat and go. Like, I just have this thing in me where I'm like, eat and leave. But, you know, there are some diners, though, you can have like two like big ass pours of wine like that. And then, then time slows down.
You order a carafe of wine at the diner. Fun. Yeah. Amos Lee, thank you so much for talking to me today on Basic Folk. This was a great interview. I really enjoyed myself. Good. And congrats.
You did a great job. Wonderful thank job you. Researching.
Thank you.
This episode of Basic Folk was produced by CJ Nungesser. Alex Stanton composes our music. Basic Folk is on the Bluegrass Situation Podcast Network. Find all of our episodes there, wherever you get podcasts. You can search for Basic Folk on the SiriusXM app. Find us on FolkAlley.com or Folk Alley's mobile app. Or check out our website, BasicFolk.com. If you enjoyed this episode, we suggest sharing it with a friend, like maybe your friend that you went to college with in the 2000s in Philadelphia, and they loved David Gray and Ray LaMontagne, and, Amos Lee. They love Amos Lee. Send it to that Philadelphia friend from college. All right, we'll talk to you next time. Thanks for listening all the way to the end. Bye.